Hi there, and welcome back to Triton Lake Perform. My name is Connor Smith, founder and CEO of Triton Lake, a global marketplace connecting sophisticated investors with alternative investment opportunities. In 2021, Triton Lake became the title sponsor of the Ireland men's and women's rugby sevens teams. This podcast explores the intersections of sport and business, looking at what both worlds can learn from each other and assessing the key parts to the puzzle of high performance. Today, for episode 4 of season 2, we're delighted to be joined by Kate Kirby. Kate is the current head of performance psychology at the Sport Ireland Institute. She has worked at the highest level of sport for over 15 years and has provided her expertise to numerous governing bodies, including the IRFU, Irish Sailing, Rowing Ireland, Hockey Ireland, Tennis Ireland, Horse Sport Ireland, numerous inter-county GAA teams, as well as attending the London, Rio and Tokyo Olympic Games as part of Team Ireland. Kate, you're very welcome to Triton Lake Perform. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Connor. I'm delighted to be here.
Maybe to set the scene a little bit, to talk about your current role, what does that day-to-day job look like as head of performance psychology?
It's a pretty varied role, and it's evolved a lot from when I started at the Institute in 2016, where I was flying the flag alone for psychology. And in that time, in that intervening few years, the team has grown to 6 performance psychologists and 2 clinical sports psychologists. So it's evolved very quickly. And my role as initially started as a service provider working with athletes in different sports, but has moved now to sort of strategically planning our service delivery across the sports and managing the team of psychologists that I'm lucky to work with, as well as doing some direct athlete and coach facing work in different sports.
Okay. And maybe that gives us a picture of what's there today, but maybe take us back in time a small bit and give us a sense of the key milestones, I guess, that led you to where you are today.
I guess when I decided sports psychology was a route I wanted to pursue, it was very much in its infancy as a profession in Ireland. We were quite far behind some other countries that had more established systems and professional pathways. So I qualified in 2015. I had to go to the UK to do a master's because there wasn't any postgraduate options available here at that time. And I came back and did a PhD under Professor Aidan Morn in UCD. And from there, I guess I just built a private practice. I was very lucky. Aidan referred a lot of people on to me. I think it originated around 2008. They brought in an accreditation system, and I was lucky enough to be one of the early people to get into that, which allowed me to work with Olympic level athletes once I'd amassed a couple of years' experience. I guess because of contacts in my own sports that I had been involved in, which were sailing and hockey, were the sports I played growing up. They were the sports I initially got opportunities in working with development athletes. And as those development athletes became senior athletes, I moved up with them and got my experience at Olympic level. For London, I was fortunate enough to be involved with Irish Sailing and Modern Pentathlon were the two sports I worked with. For Rio, I had a great experience of being there specifically just looking after Annalise Murphy in her backroom team, where she managed to win a silver medal. And then in Tokyo, my role had changed, as I mentioned, from just delivering to a limited number of athletes to managing the whole psychology system for Team Ireland, as well as working with sports like rowing, athletics, women's hockey and sailing. So I had a pretty broad brief for Tokyo.
And did that involve working with athletes as well directly, or more kind of setting out the program and you had people then in the team implementing?
It ended up being both, which was probably two people's jobs in one. And with hindsight, it was too much for one person. So I think I left Tokyo feeling like I probably hadn't done the leadership or the service delivery as well as they could have been done. And hence, for the Paris cycle, my role has kind of evolved into more of a leadership role with less service delivery and has allowed practitioners to come in and really embed in a single sport and work at a much kind of deeper, more involved level than I was able to do spread across 6 sports plus managing a team.
Yeah, okay. And then that's a nice kind of segue into the next bit. In terms of the Paris, you've been confirmed, obviously, in that lead role for the upcoming Paris Games. Talk to us a little bit about what does that mean in terms of preparation, looking ahead to it, what kind of planning happens. between now and then?
Yeah, the planning started 2 years ago. Yeah. And I, you know, a lot of the reflections around Tokyo were that, you know, when you're spread too thin, you can't build the relationships of trust that you need to and be around as much as you need for athletes and coaches to trust you, to want to confide in you, and for you to influence their systems. So realizing that allowed us to kind of recruit more people on you know, relatively smaller contracts who are dedicated to one sport in a lot of instances. So we have a psychologist specifically with boxing. We have a psychologist specifically with sailing who'll be off site in Paris. They'll be down in Marseille. And we have someone with women's hockey and someone with rowing. So now we have more dedicated practitioners, and we needed to put them in place early in the Olympic cycle to give them a good run in, to know everyone in the system, to understand the sport really well, and to be able to really influence the performances in Paris. So I suppose part of my job was identifying where those gaps were in the system and finding the right people to put into those gaps and applying for funding, making a case for that. And then I'm also still delivering service to specific sports, predominantly athletics now is what I'll be with for Paris. And then, you know, as with any leadership position, it's identifying a strategic plan for the service, identifying what our KPIs are, how do we know we're doing a good job, and taking on little extra research projects that will make what we do better, like working on things like, you know, specialist subjects like disordered eating, or we're working at the moment on looking at athletes who are struggling with nausea before they compete and even vomiting before they compete, because that's a significant performance limiting factor. Mm. And it's multifactorial. So there might be a psychological element, but there could be nutritional, medical, physiological. So bringing teams of experts together on those kind of things that require position statements and guidance for athletes and coaches.
Okay, very good. I think maybe we'll take a step back and speak more generally about the role that psychology plays in sport. It's obviously more complex than a few sentences, but maybe give us your best articulation of the role that you see it playing.
I think, you know, people will say like sport is 80% mental, which is a massive generalization and pretty inaccurate. But at the elite level, athletes do so much training and so much physical preparation. And I feel like psychology is the thing that allows them to express that physical and technical readiness. If they're mentally not in the right place, it's very hard for them to express that preparation in a way that justifies all the training that they've done. So for me, it's allowing them to understand how they respond to pressure, knowing what helps, knowing what's unhelpful, having a plan for where their attention needs to be in those critical moments. And that process takes a while to evolve, because it's not like writing a prescription for someone when they present with a certain issue, and you can, you know, in a medical model, diagnose it, write a prescription and say, do this twice a day and you'll be fine. It's a science, but it's an art as well. And so, as I mentioned earlier, that idea of being involved with an athlete for a sustained period of time is important, because each individual is different and knowing what works for one and another takes time to figure out. So for me, the goal of my work is helping an athlete to figure out what helps and what doesn't help around competition. But that takes quite a while to get to as an endpoint.
Hmm. And would you say it's the most important element in terms of contributing to elite sport, or without it, it's hard? I guess it's hard to achieve your maximum potential.
Yeah, I mean,
getting that bit right. Yeah.
Your head definitely has to be right.
Yeah.
And you know, I think sometimes psychology might be a bit proprietary about being the only people who can facilitate that, but sometimes athletes figure that out by themselves. And sometimes coaches are very skilled at that. Or they, you know, there may be someone in their backroom team who's a confidant, or maybe they have a retired athlete who's a mentor. So although psychologists have an important role to play in this and probably come at it from a more theoretical basis, they're not the only ones who own the mental performance of an athlete. Mm. That belongs to the athlete themselves, but also the other people who they trust in their inner circle. Mm. But the other aspect around psychology is, I guess, the interrelationship between how the athlete feels away from the field has a huge impact on how they perform on the field. And I think sport was slow to recognise that. And psychology was quite siloed for a long time, saying, well, if there's, you know, if you're not performing, go off and see the psychologist and they'll give you a couple of things to do and come back and perform. But actually, it's a much bigger thing. It could be, you know, stresses outside of sport, college, financial issues, work, relationship issues. And there probably is the role of psychology in understanding that interplay between the off-field and on-field mental states interacting with each other.
And that whole area of mental health obviously has been front of mind for society more and more so the last few years.
It's changed massively in the time since I qualified, like I said, in 2005. I don't think mental health was even mentioned in my master's.
Yeah.
And now it forms a significant part of the work that I do. Partly because of my role as the head of psychology, all of the clinical requests for clinical psychology support come through me, but also because you can't separate someone's mental health and mental performance. They're intertwined, and conversations very often naturally go towards how are you feeling, how are you doing, and how's that interacting with your sporting performance. But also society has changed and people's willingness to disclose mental health struggles is...
That's where the trust comes into it as well, I guess.
Yeah. So it's unrecognisable from where it was 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, okay. In this podcast, we focus a lot on what fuels performance. What would you say are the elements of performance psychology that you advise athletes to employ to maximise their performance?
It's pretty varied. For me, one of the biggest things that an athlete needs to have is some kind of plan that they can revert to that gives them a feeling of control. Control is a really key thing of like feeling you're in control of your thoughts, feeling like you're in control of executing a tactical plan, feeling like you can manage your emotions or you have a plan for how to reset. So having a plan around performance that you believe in and you have the discipline to execute when it matters is really key.
And self-belief comes into it a lot then, obviously, as well.
Yeah, it does. But that idea around self-belief has evolved a lot as well. I think when I started practicing, the model of mental toughness was really in vogue. And there was loads and loads of publications coming out around mental toughness. And that, in some ways, set up athletes to fail, because a lot of the messaging was around you have to believe in yourself 100% and back yourself and never doubt yourself. And it's total nonsense. Everyone doubts themselves. Yeah. Everyone wonders if they're good enough. There's very few athletes I know who stand on the start line or walk out on a pitch and go, oh my God, I love this pressure. It's the best feeling I've ever had. Most people go, oh my God, how can I get out of this? I wish I wasn't here. I wish I could be anywhere else. And so sending the message to athletes that they had to believe in themselves.
No matter what.
But then they doubted themselves. So then they felt like they'd already failed in the psychology part before the performance had even begun. So psychology has moved on to a much, I would say, probably kinder and more realistic model around understanding that you will doubt yourself, but that doesn't need to determine the performance outcome. But having a plan for recognizing when the doubts come in, noticing them, but not letting them dictate all of your actions, being able to shift your attention onto what's important for execution. So I think that model of believing in yourself 100% is nice in theory, but it's not the reality of how people think under pressure.
Okay. We touched on a couple of the sports that you've been involved with, but if you take something like, you know, athletics versus hockey or sailing, where does the mental fitness of an individual in one of those individual sports differ to the mental fitness in terms of a team sport?
Yeah, humans are the same. And I suppose the support that people need around managing their emotions and thoughts under pressure are not hugely different.
It's more about them as an individual than it is about the sport, I guess, right?
In some instances, yeah, for sure. That one-to-one support and building a performance plan and knowing, you know, what works for you. In team sports, always the big thing hanging over the interactions with the athletes is selection, because an individual athlete determines their own selection.
They're selected by default if they've qualified.
Exactly. Yeah, they select themselves by running a time or by qualifying. So that, I suppose, subjective decision around selection is always a real source of anxiety for athletes, because to go back to that idea of control, it's something that is somewhat within their control, but it's ultimately within the control of
the coach and
the selectors. So dealing with that anxiety is a different challenge for team sport athletes. But then the upside for them is around the shared experience of both success and disappointment. There's a real comfort in having that experience with other people and being on the journey with other people. It's quite lonely going down the individual sport route. Especially in a minority sport where you're traveling on your own, your coach doesn't even get to travel with you, you don't have a support team, you're in a hotel room by yourself, overthinking everything. That's a different challenge for individual athletes. So I suppose the environments create different challenges, but at the end of the day, people are people, and how people's brains respond to pressure is not that different.
And on that point, maybe just tease that one out a bit more. I mean, we talked about the individual aspect of psychology that's there, but are there key things that are consistent across every sports psychology type conversation or profile that all high performance athletes need to think about?
Well, I think the thing that underpins everything is self-determined motivation.
Okay.
You know, knowing the reasons that you're doing it, knowing the reasons that you've pursued this career path if you've gone towards elite sport, and having the drive to want to make yourself better all the time. That doesn't matter if you're in an individual or team sport, you can still take control of your own progression, even in a team sport environment. And sometimes people get a little passive in that. I think they just do what people tell them to do without actually investing their own thoughts or their own actions.
To understand what the driver is, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's one of the things, as we talked about, we're looking for some of the consistencies across elite sports, high-performing business, and they're very common through as well, right?
Yeah.
If we touch on maybe leadership for a second, are there key traits or characteristics that you see that good leaders have, or again, does it depend?
It's pretty varied. So I've been in teams where the captain or the leader is the talisman, or woman, the best player who sets the standards in how they perform. But I've also been in teams where the leader is maybe not the standout player, but is a solid, consistent performer and is very even-tempered and maybe has a better understanding of what the day-to-day reality is like for both the non-starters and, you know, the people who carry the burden of expectation as the stars of the team. So they're somewhere in the middle of those two extremes. Mm. And they lead in very different ways. So the star player leads in a way by what they do on the pitch and how they perform. But sometimes I've seen the additional duties of the captaincy weighs on them a lot, and often can detract because they carry the performance pressure, but then the interpersonal demands and being the captain of an international team obviously has media demands, sponsorship demands, and there's just a lot of baggage that comes with that, and that can often detract from performance. Mm. Whereas maybe the more consistent, steady type captain is better equipped to deal with that, or maybe is more systematic or structured. It's a bit of a generalization, but I don't think one is better than the other. But I think what's key for whoever gets nominated as captain is that they feel well supported enough to manage the additional burden, that it doesn't detract from their performance, because ultimately what you're there for is to perform on the pitch. And the captaincy duties should complement that, not detract from it.
And how easy is it to develop those mental capabilities around it? Do you, I mean, it's the old, are leaders born or made, right? So I know there probably need to be an element of it is born, but can be developed then further.
Yeah, I think it can be developed. Yeah. Again, to go back to that idea of the motivation, I think the first thing is that you want to be a leader and you see yourself as being a potential leader rather than being parachuted into it with no consultation. I think one of the things, how you know, whatever type of captain you are, is knowing your values and what you stand for and what's most important to you in terms of, you know, is it honesty? Is it loyalty? Is it friendship? Like, what are the things that drive your interactions with the people in the group? And they need to be aligned with the wider group values as well. So I suppose there's an art in leadership. But, you know, I think most people, if they have the desire to take on that, can be molded and shaped to add value in that sphere.
Mm. A sponsor of the Sevens teams, I guess we see firsthand the amount of time and energy that the players put into it in a high performance environment. How can those, you know, high performance athletes, Johnny Sexton, Paul O'Donovan, how do they remain at the top of their game from a mental perspective? I mean, you see someone like Johnny Sexton obviously doing it for years and years.
Yeah.
That's mentally very challenging.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I suppose there are peaks and troughs always in a career. It's not linear. One of the things that I think is people are becoming increasingly aware of is the importance of having diverse interests. And, you know, you'll see with someone like Johnny Sexton has, you know, multiple other strings to his bow, in terms of he's studied, he's got investments, he's got media responsibilities. Having other things that distract you from your sport are really important. Like, Paul is a qualified physio and now he's almost finished medicine. So he's always had a dual career or something else going on outside of rowing, because if your sole focus becomes your sport, instead of becoming a source of potential release and distraction, it actually becomes an obsession, mm-hmm. an unhealthy obsession. And generally when people overthink something to that degree, it just makes them worse. Mm. So for me, that interaction, and it, you know, it's something that Rugby Players Ireland are working a lot on, is that dual career development, both to prepare people to prepare athletes for life after sport. But I think we're only becoming aware of the performance benefits during a career to athletes having alternative interests and alternative identities, not just having this narrow view of themselves as an elite athlete.
And different tribes of people, I guess, around them as well, with those different interests, right? Not just the same.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Over the course of your career, high performance sports and the nature of the sports industry has changed a lot. There's been ups and downs. Is there a time that stands out when things weren't going right? And how did you make improvements to the bits you were in control of then?
Yeah, I mean, I've been involved in a lot of situations that weren't going well. I think one for me that stands out that was it was a challenging situation, was where athletes were dissatisfied with the lead of their sport, and the lead of the sport was dissatisfied with the athletes, and I was the intermediary. Mm. But I felt I was compromised because I had strong relationships with both and had been in the sport for a long time, that it was very difficult for me to step back also and look at how this could be resolved. So I decided to bring in an external. So in what probably should have been my job around conflict resolution, I recognized that I was too enmeshed in it to take an objective view, and brought in an experienced coach from a completely different sport who had no interaction with any of the stakeholders, and just went and kind of got to the root of what was going on. Because what was happening was people started nitpicking around, you know, small details, and couldn't see the bigger picture. So by bringing that person in some ways it was, I just had to park my ego and go, I don't think I'm the right person to fix this.
Too close to it almost.
Yeah. And I became part of the review process as opposed to leading it. And it was a really valuable experience, because the person who came in, you know, published a report with three or four key things that I probably wouldn't have seen. And also just the whole process of actually sitting down and talking to someone else was kind of cathartic for everyone in the system, where afterwards people weren't nitpicking as much. They kind of saw a way forward or plotted a way forward with more clarity. So for me, that was one that it was an important learning for me, was knowing that or not knowing, but figuring out that I actually wasn't making it better by being in the middle of it.
Very good. If we think about performance outside of sport, so be it in business or personal life, what are some of the elements of sports psychology that can be applied? I mean, we obviously just touched on one with the different interest one, which I think is hugely important, even from my own perspective, I know that.
Yeah.
Are there other particular ones?
I've done a little bit of corporate work, yeah. Not a huge amount, but one of the things that often surprises me is employees often work in an organization without clarity on what the overall goal is. Mm-hmm. So they're in day-to-day doing their jobs, but they don't see how...
What the vision is.
The vision of the organization is. So, and that's really important, both to stay on task and not get sidetracked, but also just for that kind of internalized motivation to know, well, what are we going, what are
what
we traveling towards?
What am I contributing to, even,
right? And knowing how your piece of the puzzle fits with the overall picture, because a lot of people are really familiar with theirs, with their piece, but not with what other people are doing. So I think that's really important, just, and it's often overlooked by management, who they know, but they don't necessarily think to communicate that well to people at other levels. And the second thing is that I've really noticed that business can learn from sport is being very systematic about reviews. Mm. So not individual performance reviews, which, you know, companies often do, maybe an annual, giving an employee a score out of 10 or whatever, but actually after a project ends or a specific time period, sitting down and going, well, what were our objectives? What did we do to try to achieve those objectives? Did we succeed? If not, why not? If we did, why did we, and what can we replicate going forward? And a bit like I said earlier about the reviewer coming in, distilling learnings down to two or three really key points of things you want to repeat, but also things that you need to do better. I feel in business, people often just lurch from one project to the next and they wipe their brow when it's over and go on to the next thing.
If it worked, great, let's do it again, without actually thinking what went well and what could we do better.
Okay. It's something sport invests a lot of, certainly Olympic sport invests a lot of time. Like, it takes time and money to bring in a consultant to do a review, or even to take time out of your day-to-day job to go and do a review. So, I mean, as an example, I came in as an external for Irish Hockey in 2017, the year before their World Cup, that they ended up getting to the final, winning the silver medal. The coach brought me in as an external, and I think it was 5 days work for me to plan the review, collect the data, do an analysis and come in and present to the team. And that 5 days got us to the point of what needed to change and what was going well. It wasn't the how. Hmm. Like, that, I left that to them because I didn't need to be involved in that detail. But that's a significant investment for a sport to pay for someone's time, and for the athletes and coaches to take time out themselves to feed into a review like that. But I think it can really keep you on track and keep the main thing the main thing. And for me, that's something that I've seen some sports do well. And when I've spoken to corporates, they would say it's not something that they would do systematically.
And with that hockey example, were the findings of that review something then that fed into them getting the silver medal the next year, would you say? Or
I think so. I mean, I'm certainly not taking any credit for their success, but I think it allowed them, you know, a lot of times it's a risk with team sports that people get caught in complaining about what should be better and don't recognize what's actually really good. It gets taken for granted. So they certainly did make some changes. I don't think it was an overhaul of the whole program, but there were some things identified that could be done better on and off the field.
Okay. That's great, Kate. One thing we're asking people as a kind of a wrap-up question is if there's a piece of advice that you'd give to someone who's looking to establish themselves as a leader in a high-performance environment. Anything that springs to mind?
I think to go back to that idea of being clear on your values, who you are and how you want to perform shouldn't change significantly because of the environment you're in. And I've worked in environments where I wasn't comfortable with how things were being done. And because I knew what was important to me, I was able to step away from them more easily. Even if it was a career opportunity lost, potentially, I still knew it wasn't a good fit for me. So I think knowing who you are and what you stand for is a foundation.
It's true of anything, not just high performance, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's key. And I think if you know that and you can go into an environment knowing who you are and what you have to offer, you'll figure it out, or you'll be adaptable to different situations.
Kate, thanks for joining us today. It's been extremely interesting and insightful to learn about the importance and impact that psychology can have in sport and in high performance. We wish you the very best of luck in the next steps of your career, and thank you for all the work that you do behind the scenes for Irish athletes and coaches.
Thank you, Conor.
So that's all for episode 4 of season 2 of Triton Lake Perform. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Stay tuned as we look forward to chatting to a great lineup of guests across the rest of the season.